Hi, I'm Frank.
I'm Deshaun.
From Real Books Don't Have Batman.
And you're listening to Superhero Speak. Now, Frank, when they say Superhero Speak, do they mean there are actually superheroes on this podcast discussing things?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Really?
Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave.
And John.
And this week we have a guest with us. He is one of the wonderful writers over at Zenoscope Comics. He's currently working on the Clash of Queens miniseries, which is wrapping up shortly. Everyone, please welcome Troy Brownfield.
Thanks, guys.
How are you doing this evening?
Pretty well. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. So, actually, before we get into the interview too much, we actually have started a new thing here on Superhero Speak, and this is the first time we're doing it with a guest, so this will be fun.
I'll be gentle.
We do a little segment, which this is really for audience participation, and it's called Stump the Geek.
Oh.
So we ask a question each week. People answer on Twitter and Facebook, and if they hit the right answer, we randomly pick a person, and they're the geek of the week.
Nice.
No one got this week's question right. So I'm going to ask you and see if you have a guess.
Uh-oh.
That's what happens when you ask them what number you're thinking of.
Pie.
So the question from last week was, who was the first major character to die in a Marvel comic?
Ooh, that's an excellent question. Professor Horton.
I think
would that be Marvel Comics number one, Android Human Torch's creator?
That is actually... Okay, so there was a stipulation, because they had to stay dead. It was Marvel Comics, but they were timely at the time, and I did stipulate when I asked the question, this is when they were Marvel Comics.
Okay, first character that died and stayed dead, Marvel. Hero or villain? I should ask that. Hero, villain, or supporting character?
It is a hero.
Oh man, and stayed dead. Wow. See, because my first impulse would be, I think they revealed the death of Bucky in like Avengers number 4.
Right.
And then their original Baron Zemo died pretty quickly after that. Man, that's an awesome question. I'm going to go with Bucky and see what happens. One of the Howling Commandos died early on too. I know that. That was a big shock.
There you go. You were, if you had gone with your second instinct, you would have gotten it. It was Jonathan Junior Juniper, who was one of the Howling Commandos, the youngest of the Howling Commandos, and he died in Sergeant Fury in the Howling Commandos number 4, which was November 1963.
What'd they have about 4? I mean,
so
it's like,
yeah,
fourth issue, we got to kill somebody.
And it's actually in the comics. It is he's one of the only characters who has stayed dead. And it's a death that has haunted Nick Fury to this day in the comics. So,
through all of Nick's various twists and turns.
Yes. All right. So the question this week, this one's a little easier. See, I think a lot of people guessed Bucky, a couple of people Uncle Ben, got some Gwen Stacy's in there. This one I think's a little easier. It's again a Marvel related question. When did Captain America first throw his shield? And as a bonus, who wrote the story? You don't have to give a guess, because this is for the audience. But you can think about that during the interview, and maybe we'll get back to it at the end.
Okay.
So, Troy.
Not that. I'm pretty sure I know this one, but we'll let it sit there and,
yes,
and percolate.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, I think this is a lot easier. So you're a writer. Have you always wanted to be a writer?
Yeah, I mean, that's really fair to say. It's been in various permutations, but comics was always something I wanted to do. And, the prose thing has gone up and down over the years, but I think it's pretty fair to say I've always wanted to write comics in some capacity. I've been a fan, you know, nearly my entire life, so.
Do you remember the first comic you read?
You know, I have a pretty clear memory of the first couple that, you know, I remember having for sure. You know, I know I had one of the early issues of Super Friends, number 10, that was based on the TV show, which, if I remember, I think it was number 10. It's the one where they fight the characters that look like the Universal Monsters, and they find out that they're actually the Justice League of an alternate Earth.
Huh.
And that the villain they're after is the helpless blonde is actually the Sinestro of that universe. And so the Dracula is really Batman and so forth. And, you know, I was kind of into Universal Monsters at the time, so it was a big deal.
You know? Right, right.
Nice.
And I also had Star Wars number one when it came out. So that didn't come out right with the film. So we're talking, you know, I was about 4 or 5 years old. So definitely those two. Early on.
Cool. And so this is something I'm curious about. So you said you've always wanted to write comics. Is that something like you went to school for and then you pursued it right away, or how did you end up, you know, actually beginning to do it?
Well, it's it was kind of roundabout in a way. I mean, it's kind of funny because you talk about this when you're, you know, in the journalism side, like I've been and you guys are, and when you're in the creative side, and you kind of philosophize on it, you know, comics is that one field of entertainment where nearly everybody that's a fan of it kind of also wants to do it.
Right.
At some level. You can go to a movie and say, I loved that, and not want to be an actor.
Right, right.
And you could go, you know, you could go to sporting events and be like, oh, that was great, I had a good time, but you know, there's no way on earth you'd ever compete at that level. With comics, I feel like nearly everyone who reads them would just as happily create them. And that, you know, that's great. That's awesome. It's just, unfortunately, not everybody gets the chance, and it's really, really hard to get the chance, to do it over a period of time. And with my educational background, I was an English major, and my original thing, and, you know, I hope this is entertaining to you guys. I thought about law initially.
Okay.
And, you know, English is one of those things. There's a bunch of keystone fields that you would go into, for your PA, and then you would enter law school. But I did English because I loved writing. You know, I was in creative writing track and everything, and that kind of went by the wayside, you know, soon. Along with 8 o'clock classes, you know, and you start college in that first year, you're like, hey, I've been getting up at 7 my whole life to go to high school. I can put 8 o'clock classes on the schedule. And by the second semester, wow, that was stupid. So then, you know, so it pretty quickly became more of a focus on writing. And then I got my master's with a creative writing focus. And then, you know, I've worked as a college professor a lot of that time and written. So doing both of those things.
Okay. And so you've worked for Fangoria?
Yeah, I worked for the Fangoria Comics imprint.
Okay.
Which was complicated.
Okay.
The website as a blogger doing different things. As a matter of fact, I think I talked about the Universal Monsters issue of Super Friends on there one time. But mainly I worked on classic features as a blogger for Fangoria. I did a feature called Unkillable Classics, where I focused on things like the 30s movies and so forth. Because, okay. I grew up loving Fangoria, and it's one of those funny things that, like, you know, I have a distinct memory of my mom not letting me get the Raiders of the Lost Ark cover issue because, you know, it had Toad's face melting on the cover. And I remember my argument, I've seen this movie, you know.
Right, right, like, exactly.
It doesn't bother me. It was in the film. It's just, you know, it's a picture of that. We saw it. Me and you and Dad, you know, and not being allowed to buy it. And so I thought, you know, kind of like 30 years later, here I am right for Fangoria. I'm like, ha, gotcha, Mom. with the Fangoria thing, it was a little complicated because I had become friends with Scott Lucina, who created Grave Girls and had his own small press thing, Midnight Show. And I got along great with him. I first met him when he'd sent some stuff to be reviewed to Newsarama. Met him in Chicago, and honestly, this is one of those weird things. He looks a lot like a friend of mine that was a real close friend that actually passed away a couple of years prior. Mm-hmm. And when I ran into this dude in Chicago, and I didn't realize it was Scott, because we'd only ever talked by email at one point, and I'm like, wow, this guy looks like James. And I got up closer, and I like, it was Scott, and I just couldn't believe it. And it was, you know, we had a lot of stuff in common, and it became a real easy association. And so I said to Scott, like, hey, man, I want to do something with Midnight Show. And Scott's like, oh, great, great. You know, whatever ideas you got. And then a couple of months into that association, he's like, okay, I got to tell you something. We're not going to be Midnight Show anymore. I'm like, oh, what's going on? He's like, we're going to be doing Fangoria. I'm like, what? He's like, you're the associate editor. Okay. You know, and it just kind of went like that. He had made the deal and pitched the comics line to them at that time. Mm-hmm. And so Scott was the executive editor, and, you know, Troy, you're the associate. Mark Kidwell, who now does 68 for Image. Kidwell was one of the early guys in there. Jesse Snyder, D's son, Jesse, who has written Toy Story and Deadpool and whatnot. He was in that group, too. And so very suddenly we found ourselves being Fangoria Comics in 2006.
Wow. That's a kind of a cool gig to fall into.
Yeah, it was. It was weird. And we immediately, we had some support from the, I'll do the short version of what happened. We had some support. Fangoria was going through this big outgrowth. They were, they did a capitalization campaign to put together a film studio. They had capitalized, if I remember correctly, about $150 million, with the, it was like ICM and CAA, some of the big talent agencies, you know, they were helped capitalize, and there are all these things going on about venture capitalists and people being involved. And the group at the time, the creative group behind Fangoria were two things. There was two associations, Creative Group and Mo Green Entertainment, which is, you know, auspicious. We're going to be in business with Mo Green from The Godfather. Mm-hmm. And then we started putting out the comics, and they wanted to do stuff in the comics that could be made into films. And so you had this early association with, like, D. Snyder doing the Strangeland sequel that was a Strangeland comic. And Michael Madsen developed a comic. And very quickly, we started putting this stuff together. And almost as quickly, the partners dissolved into fighting. There was bankruptcy. They pulled the plug on the comics. They pulled the plug. The movie studio thing never happened. And all this kind of stuff collapsed and went away. And then it had a brief resurgence after the one partner got a hold of it, and he started to do it again, and they started to do, like, very early digital versions of the stuff, like pre-comiXology. Mm-hmm. And then that went away, too, in kind of a – it was kind of like the Fangoria version of the Red Wedding. By the time it was over, Scott wasn't there. The guy that was the editor-in-chief of the magazine for 30 years, Tony Timpone, wasn't there. It was, like, new editor-in-chief, no comics, wow. You know, and it's, like, that, when that dust settled, it was done. I mean, it was like scorched earth. But, you know, during the time that it was happening, it was an incredible education. Mm. We got stuff out on time. We sold lots and lots of books. We had stuff being sold on the rack at Barnes & Noble, which a lot of people did not have comics in the magazine section of Barnes & Noble at the time. There were heavy hitters asking us for advice about how we got the stuff in, which was easy. We got it in because of Fangoria.
Right.
It's like, you find a magazine that you want to attach yourselves to. Say People. And, you know, but it was just the thing. It's like they had this newsstand presence for decades. They had Starlog. Right. They had Comic Scene when they ran it. They had Gore Zone. And so Fangoria says to Ingram or Barnes & Noble, hey, we want to put comics on the rack. They're like, yeah, sure. And so it made a difference. But at the time, that we were selling three times on the newsstand what we were in the comic shops, and which was big deal.
Right.
you could have stayed alive on that for a long time. And but because of the vagaries of everything that happened, only the first miniseries ever got completed on the newsstand. The second miniseries, that was Bump that Kidwell did. The second miniseries, Beneath the Valley of the Rage, which was written by Robert Kurtzman. Three of the four issues came out, and the fourth one did come out at conventions.
Okay.
Some of them never finished. And, you know, it became another kind of footnote, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, there's a lot of those, especially in the last decade with just publishing in general.
Yeah.
I actually, I used to work many moons ago for TV Guide. And so, yeah, I...
Which size?
the original, the...
Original size, yeah.
Yeah.
I became immediately suspicious when they went to the big size. I'm like, you know, well, that wasn't it's even... like an old brand, you don't recognize them anymore.
Well, that wasn't even the same company anymore. That's when...
oh, okay.
There was a finance company that had bought them out and tried to relaunch the magazine. And, yeah, they thought, oh, we'll print it at a bigger size. And it's like, well, no, that wasn't the problem. So, yeah, but, I mean, that was... You know, that was one of those writing on the wall for publishing industry moments. You just you knew it walking around like, we need to look for new jobs. So
situation a couple of times where you're all sitting there going, I thought we were supposed to have work coming in. Oh, that's all right. Just keep playing video games. Okay. This can't possibly go badly.
No, not at all. So from there you went to, I had notes. So where did you go after Fangoria?
To the bar.
Okay.
Well, anyway, let's see. That was about 2006. So I was already doing Newsarama at that point.
Okay.
I'd started working for Newsarama regularly in 2004. I had been doing stuff for some other sites like Pulse and, I had been writing for the New Type USA magazine.
Mm-hmm.
It was the American version of the Japanese New Type anime and manga magazine, and it had been launched in the U.S. by ADV Films, who at the time was putting out, they had the DVD rights to Farscape. They were doing the Robotech and Macross stuff, a lot of big name, anime and manga. And so they had the magazine. It was an awesome magazine. One of those, original Rolling Stone size magazines came packaged with the DVD. Mm-hmm. To sample stuff and like big, beautiful covers. And, a couple of the PR guys, got me into writing it because at that time, in 1999, I launched the Shotgun Reviews site, which was the first thing that I did really big. And so I had been doing reviews for a lot of years and those guys knew me from that and they got me into that. By that point, I'd been writing in the newspapers and some other magazines and whatnot, but then, New Type segued me to Newsarama and The Pulse. I wrote for The Pulse, the ComicCon.com is The Pulse with Heidi McDonald and Jen Catino. This is before Heidi went off and made the beat. And in 04, I ran into Mike Sangiacomo, who was writing for Newsarama at the time at the Mid-Ohio Con. And he's like, you should talk to Matt Brady. You guys get along great. And so I pitched Matt Brady on doing this. This is just so funny considering later on, but I pitched him on doing some indie reviews, stuff from Top Shelf and then some manga stuff. And so, pretty quickly, he let me put together the Best Shots review column, which still goes on Newsarama. And, you know, I became the captain of that. And like all of a sudden I was a regular contributor at Newsarama and, Matt and I became great friends. We're still friends. We've co-written stuff, like the Buck Rogers annual and Batman story. And, that Newsarama opened door after door.
Yeah.
You know, it was while I was working at Newsarama that I met Scott for Midnight Show and then Fangoria. I met Nick Perucci, Dynamite. I met the Zenoscope guys, you know, and everybody that will tell you, like within the framework of blogging and journalism and stuff, it's not a guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
you do meet people, which puts you way, way above, you know, what you might have thought you could do.
Right.
And for a long period of time, even though I had the aspirations to do the writing and stuff, for a long period of time, I thought, you know, I had kind of wandered into like the absolute coolest thing I could do with it. You know, because at a certain point in your life, you start to think, well, I've taken this as far as it's going to go.
Right.
And, you know, I was, there's a lot of that stuff that was very, very cool, about doing that. And I was a regular, like everyday contributor for Newsarama for 7 years, really.
Huh. Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny. I definitely agree with that. Even since we started doing this, we've met people and made connections, and it's, you know, it always surprises me. You do fall into that. Like, even if you just do it, even if you just do something like this for fun, you end up talking to people and they get interested in what you're doing and so
yeah.
So you worked for Newsarama, then you were writing for them 2004 for a while then.
And you know, and I have to say some of the highlights of if you'd say, I guess you could say my career, I always feel really weird saying stuff like that. You know, there's a lot of stuff about this whole thing that I still feel very, very weird about saying or claiming, you know. It's like, I write comic books, you know, it's like a weird thing to say. It's like, I don't even believe it sometimes, you know, because you have this weird kind of thing where you're sitting at home and you're typing on your computer and it's like, I'm really not putting words on the screen that somebody's going to draw and somebody else is going to color and somebody else. It's not going to happen. That's ridiculous. The idea that that's ridiculous. The book comes in the mail and you're like, it's a strange thing. It's very strange to even see that it's happened still to me.
But I need to ask though, you know, cause yes, like to you and me and John, you sit there and say, oh, I write comic books for a living and that's really cool and I can't believe it. And in our circle, yes, like, that's really cool. Or if we were at Comic-Con, it'd be really cool. But if you're at the bar and you're trying to pick up somebody, is it really cool then?
Absolutely. It has never failed. I'm kidding. I don't know. It probably works more than it used to.
That's true.
Like, so I write comic books. Like the Avengers? Oh, shit. You know, there's a different level of kind. There's kind of a different level of recognition on that. Well, let me back up on one of those things a minute. I think you guys will be enormously entertained by it. With the Newsarama thing, I'd say that there's like a couple of life highlights, you know, just out of the Newsarama thing. They're just really awesome. And like some people, you know, if they do like movie stuff a lot, then they get kind of jaded with it. I'm not. And so, you know, when Dark Knight was shooting in Chicago, Brady calls me up, and I knew it was a big thing when Brady called. Right, it was always something big when Brady called, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, I hope he listens to this so he could, because, you know, it's usually like instant message or email or whatever, but it's like when Matt called him, like, oh, Matt's calling, what's going on? You know, Disney's going to buy Marvel. You know, and Matt's, he's like, how close are you to Chicago? Like about 3 hours. You want to go to Chicago? Like for the convention? No, Warner called and I can't go to Chicago. And I said, you'd probably want to go to the Dark Knight set.
Okay.
Like, yeah. All right. Well, it's Friday. Can you do Friday? You know, and it's that like that. And Matt would do these things where he's just like downplaying it to just, you know, mess with you.
Right.
He's like, yeah, so go to the Dark Knight set. And so, you know, when you go to the Dark Knight set and interview Gary Oldman and stuff, that's another one of those things like, what? Like, get out. Really? That's not happening. I've got some really awesome drugs and I think I'm doing this, but you know, it's not me. But so there's that, but over time. And like when I was teaching, you had some students and stuff that would really be into that and they want to hear everything about it. And they think it's the coolest thing ever. And so that's great. And then you meet some people and you do some shows and stuff. And some people think it's really fantastic. And then you have, everyday people who just don't quite know how to respond to it.
Right.
It's like, what do you do? Well, I teach and I write comic books. What kind of comic books? Is it something I've heard of, you know, as an early thing? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they start to ask some questions. And then sometimes people will realize very quickly that they have nowhere else to go with it. And then other people will start asking like really arcane questions about the Marvel movies and stuff. It's like, I think I was supposed to understand this thing and I didn't really. So the thing that looked like a white Rubik's cube, what was that? and you know, so it becomes really interesting kind of conversational piece. And
yes.
My wife and I joke a lot about, you know, Chris Rock had this routine about when married couples go out. And it's usually because the wives are all friends. And then the husbands get stuck in the, like, the little kid table. And they, like, will walk the husband over and, like, introduce the husband. And it's like, this is Chris. He likes baseball. Oh, hi. I like baseball, too. you know, and it's like, I've become in some of those circles, like, all the questions about the movies and stuff and the video games and everything come to me. Yeah, Troy, I was playing Lego Marvel with my kid, and this one guy shows up, and I have no idea who is it. You know, what's MODOK? What is that? You know, and so I find myself doing that a lot.
No, I completely understand, and it's not for the same reason. I'm a computer programmer in my day life, so you know, you go over a brother-in-law's house. Oh man, I'm having a problem with my computer. Can you look at it? What's going on here?
I think the tweets are wrong. The tweets are wrong. What's wrong with the tweet? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's like my mom, you know, asking about the DVR. You know, that's that kind of thing, right?
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
I've run out of room on my DVR. How? It's like, well, it's oh, you're not deleting anything. You're supposed to delete it after you watch it, Mom. If you don't, yeah.
Yes. Yes. You have an entire season of a show on here. Are you watching it? I already watched it. Then delete it.
It doesn't say the titles. They don't have titles on Young and the Restless, Mom.
So yeah, and actually, you know, it's funny. I would with Newsarama, now that we're on that, one of the things I really like about doing this podcast is having a nice long form conversation with someone and getting to know them and whatnot.
Yeah.
But when you do an interview for Newsarama, is it more of like a press junket type interview where you've got like five questions, boom, 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 and then you have to move on, or?
Yeah, sometimes very real. Other times it's, it depends. Rick Remender likes to talk on the phone, which, I mean, have you guys interviewed Remender before or?
No, not yet.
Yeah, he would be awesome. I mean, he's a great interview, but he particularly likes to talk on the phone, which is cool. He doesn't like to do the email interview, you know, in my experience. So, you know, he'd be somebody to call and talk to. I did long phone interviews with Gerard Way, you know, for My Chemical Romance and Umbrella Academy. The label set that up, strangely enough. And like, you couldn't call them. They had to call you. So it was like, you had to be at the phone at a certain time. It's like, hold for Gerard Way. Like, thank you. He was like the most normal freaking guy. It was just like any other dude you would talk to enthusiastically in the comic shop, who just happened to be selling millions of records. And you know, he's like, that was a hysterically funny conversation. Yeah. So my brother and I, we pitched this cartoon to Nickelodeon and they didn't pick it up. And then we're like, yeah, we'll make a band. Good work. You know, good idea.
Yes, exactly. That's how those ideas always go.
Yeah, it was rough for him. There's some, you know, that for anyone listening, yes, I know he decided after September 11th because he realized about the presence of mortality, and he thought that if he and his brother did want to start a band, that they wanted to start it now because hey, this kind of stuff can happen. So there, I didn't disrespect the origin of the band. It's it's still very dark. You know.
Yes.
Welcome to the Black Parade. I get it.
I guess then how did you end up with the guy from Zenoscope?
That was at the bar, right?
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Is it really that good a story? You have to think about it.
Well, man, there might be legalities involved. The short form of this is I met Raven Gregory first. And I met Raven through a friend. And the first time that I had, I don't know, I guess conversation of any real length with Raven was at the Hyatt Bar in Chicago in about, I don't know, 2007, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Raven was doing The Gift. Met Ralph the same night. They were the Seven comic was coming out about the same time that they did based on the film. Grim Fairy Tales had just started, and you know, it was just a you know, hey, nice to meet you guys, sit around, trade stories. there was other Fangoria weirdness going on at the time, but you know, it wasn't, there was no conflict in hanging out with those guys. All the Fangoria guys and like a lot of the Zenoscope guys were all hanging out together. I remember Sean McManus that night, a bunch of the Newsarama guys, Lucas Siegel, who runs Newsarama, now, who's a side editor after Matt stepped down a few years ago. We were all there. You know, it was just everybody was hanging out. And, Raven and I kept in touch because, you know, we hit it off. And at a certain point, Raven asked if I was interested in pitching some short stories for a Wonderland annual that was going to happen in 2010. Mm-hmm. I pitched three ideas looking through Wonderland and looking through the Lewis Carroll books and some of his poems and just picking some ideas out. And I pitched three things, like The Lion and the Unicorn and a version of Rear Window with the girl in the wheelchair that lived across from the Little House, and then a White Knight story. And the White Knight story was taken and expanded into an issue of Tales from Wonderland, which became the first thing I wrote for them, was Tales from Wonderland, the White Knight. Mm. It was like issue three of the second Tales set of miniseries. So 2010 was technically the first thing with that. And then after that, I got the chance to, with Matt Brady, we had pitched some stuff to the Batman office at DC a few times. Because, you know, again, Matt knows everybody. Everybody that's in comics, right. You know. And Janelle, now Janelle Aslan Moore, but Janelle Aslan, she had been on the Best Shots team with me. We had, Scott and I had talked, and Scott picked her up as the assistant editor for Fangoria. She went to DC and became assistant and associate editor on the Batman books. And, you know, we had pitched Mike Martz and Janelle a couple of times with a couple of different stories for 80-page giants that didn't make it, you know, like a spoiler story and a story about Damian trying to imitate the other Robins and realizing that it didn't work for him, that he just had to be Damian. And and then eventually the story that got picked up for the 2011 80-page giant that Matt and I did, which was a story called Short Straw. And that same year, 2011, I was on the Dynamite beat for Newsarama. So Nick Barucci and I talked all the time. Like anytime Dynamite was doing a new thing or new promotion or anything, you know, I was always talking to Nick. He'd call me. We'd talk a lot. You know, we communicated frequently. And so I was at a show. It was C2E2. And Matt and I had something. And, you know, I was running down a list of interviews and stuff that Nick was going to set up. And we're like, hey, we've got this idea. We were thinking about running it by it. He's like, oh, that sounds cool. Hey, do you guys want to write a Buck Rogers annual? And we're like, what? And he's like, we need a, he's like, wait. And this is, you know, it's very Nick. He's like, we're going to do a Buck Rogers annual. You want to do Buck Rogers annual? I thought you guys might want to do a Buck Rogers annual. You got a story for Buck Rogers annual? No. Think of a story for the Buck Rogers annual. Let me know. I'm like, all right. I'm supposed to do a panel. I'm supposed to go cover. And it was a toy panel. I can't remember which one. I take that back. I think they were announcing DC Universe Classics.
Okay.
So I'm walking and I've got like all these notes. I'm like, DC's supposed to announce something big. And I'm on the way, like, from the main hall to that. I'm like, what is wrong with Nick? Buck Rogers story? I don't have a Buck Rogers story. What do I do with the Buck Rogers story? And so I call Matt, and I'm like, I didn't get him right away. I got his voice filled. Like, Nick just asked me to pitch a Buck Rogers story. I'm like, what are you, it's crazy. I don't have a Buck Rogers story. And a few more feet, and I'm like, well, that'd be cool. That's a good idea. And I'm getting to the hall where the panel is. I'm calling Matt back. I'm like, don't worry about it. I've got a Buck Rogers story. 20 minutes later, my phone rings. I don't answer it because I'm in the panel. And then my phone starts shaking. I look at it, and there's this text from Matt, like all caps, what Buck Rogers story? And so that's like, you know, so we came back to Nick, and we're like, here's our Buck Rogers story. It's like, it's too big. Okay, how about this part of the story? That's okay. You know, and it became that 2011 Buck Rogers annual.
Right. So actually, you know, that's a question I have too. So you went to school for English. You love comic books. You're a creative person. Now, most of the people, most of the writers that we've had on the show so far are indie writers. So they're writing their own stuff. And you worked on a lot of pre-existing properties.
Mm-hmm.
What is the, I mean, obviously there's a big difference between working on someone else's properties and working on your own ideas. So if you are asked to write a Buck Rogers story or a Batman story and you come up with all these ideas, are you given free rein or do they kind of tell you, well, here's the parameters and you have to write within these parameters? Like, how does that work?
It's a little of both. To be clear, you know, there's a part of me, you know, I do the webcomic thing. Like at sparkshooter.com, I have the sparkshooter and sell acoustic webcomics. And like, there's a part of me that's like, I hate to say fulfilled because I don't want it to sound too much like creative writing class. I'm fulfilled. You know, I would also be fulfilled if it paid the mortgage. Yeah, like there's a part of me that's like, okay, you know, I am getting to tell my own story. So, you know, put on the work hat and do some stuff for some other people is cool. Cause, you know, I enjoy that too. The thing of it is some of them have a more distinct set of rules about them. But within that distinct set of rules, you can come up with some pretty great stuff. Certainly there's a lot of Batman rules. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we flew afoul of them, because, you know, Matt and I both grew up with Batman to the extent that it's like, you know, I can't think of anybody who's interested in comics that doesn't have at least like 5 Batman stories that they've thought of, you know, and you pretty much have a good idea. You know, Batman's not going to stab anybody to death. You know, there's certain things Batman won't do. So going into that, you have an idea. Zenoscope, is interesting because Joe and Ralph, Joe Brusch and Ralph Tedesco have a vision, and they will frequently articulate the short form of the vision, and then kind of let you build on what they have pictured, and you can do lots of different things and take it lots of ways within that. And sometimes it's immediate and it's like, that's good, go with it. And other times you have to do a couple of drafts of it.
Okay.
And other times Raven thinks he's going to be able to kill everybody, and then you end up writing it a couple of times, you know, which happens. And it's cool as long as you have the understanding, you know. I know it's very much playing with someone else's toys.
Right.
And at the end of the day, you give those toys back and they take them home. But it was cool to play with them for a while.
Right, right. And Zenoscope's, you know, interesting in their own way, because they're taking classic fairy tale characters and reinventing them, you know.
Yeah. And
so I was going to say, so do you get fans who come back to you and go, oh, I don't believe that, you know, the White Queen would ever do that? Or,
well, I mean, yeah.
Really?
usually in reviews. which is the grand irony. I talked to David Pepos, who's like a great friend of mine, but you know, he's the team captain of the Best Shots team at Newsarama now. And it's funny because you walk a line as a reviewer where you're like, you don't want to be too much for one side or the other. You have to be, you know, casual about certain things, and you don't want to take things too personally. And it's really funny when you make the flip, because it's like, you used to be like, oh, I wasn't writing anything that should offend that writer. And now you're like, you're on the writer's side. It's like, that little shit. you know? And so I get it. I it's more funny at the end of the day than anything else. But really, I think that most of the readers are really respectful about it. And when I've met a lot of people, they've just been really totally cool. I haven't really gotten too much of that. You know, not to step too far outside the Zenoscope box for a second, but I got more crap about the announcement of the Blood Queen series at Dynamite when, you know, we were talking about using Elizabeth Bathory as a starting point, and there were guys coming out of the woodwork like, you know, they don't think Elizabeth Bathory really killed all those girls. Like, what? I don't think Dracula, you know, I don't think Vlad Tepish actually ate people's necks either.
Right, dude. Right.
You know, at a certain point, there's a legend that happens, and, you know, you either indulge it or you don't. You know, I don't think Alan Moore actually knew Jack the Ripper. I mean,
are you sure? Know,
well, maybe. I don't. I'm leaving it wide open.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to say too much because then he appears. You know, it's like, I don't know what Brownfield was talking about me in that interview, but
yes, you have to be careful about what we say about Alan Moore.
Well, you know, but you know, it's most of them have been really, really great and respectful and cool interactions. And I think, you know, I'm in Indiana, which is, its own thing. And if I do signings at like the local comic shop and stuff, I think people are just kind of mystified to realize that there are people who are writing comic books who live near them.
Right.
you're like, you know, some of the people, like last week I did one and people were kind of, there were some people who didn't know and they're like, you live here? Like, I thought everybody was like on the East Coast. And
like, no, I mean, that's one of the great parts about, I think, the internet is that, you don't have to live in New York and work in comics anymore.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so it's interesting with respect to that. Now with Joe and Ralph, I mean, they started with the intent of kind of just telling, you know, retelling those modern versions of fairy tales. Mm-hmm. And, Sela, in a way, in the original Grimm Fairy Tales issues, for lack of a better word, she's kind of like Rod Serling, when he appeared on camera in those early Twilight Zone episodes when right. they would pan over and Serling would be standing in the study and, you know, he'd be like, we're going to tell this story. This story is going to freak you out. and then they would pan back to the show as it's going on, and Sela kind of functioned that way. She'd meet the people, she'd show them the book, you know, mm-hmm. don't be a douchebag. And they would see the things, the consequences of said douchebaggery refracted through a fairy tale. And it was really, it was cool. It was like modern day morality plays. And over time, they built that into this kind of branching universe where Sela becomes kind of like the Wonder Woman character. And it, if you look at like Grimm Fairy Tales number 1 and Grimm Fairy Tales number 50, they are light years apart. And they built a really cool interpretation of that. And, you know, I respect those guys. If there's certain things they want to do and certain things they don't want to do, they've earned the right to tell you that as right. creators, because they're inviting you in to that playground, in a sense. You know, and my real heavy introduction into that was when I got brought in for a Myths and Legends, which was another Raven thing. Mm-hmm. It was like Raven literally called me. One time, it was just, I got a message, like, Troy, this is Raven, give me a call. Like, all right. I call him, he's like, hey, man, think you can write Grimm Fairy Tales, Myths, and Legends number 18? Like, sure, how about 19? I think I do that. Maybe 20 and 21? all right, do you guys have a story? Yeah, give me a call back tomorrow. All right, so I call you back tomorrow. Yeah. So I'm thinking it's going to be 22 to 25 too. You think you could do that? Like, all right. A couple days later, Raven's on Twitter, like, Troy Bradfield's the new regular writer on Grim Fairy Tales, Myths and Legends. Nice. But it was just like that, you know, it was one of those things where it's like, they gave me a couple ideas. It's like, we kind of want to do this. Mm-hmm. I've added some plot stuff back and forth. 18 through 21 was approved like that. 22 through 25 took more time because it was a big culmination of all the stuff they'd been doing in the book. It had Sela in it, had Red Riding Hood in it. It was like a big crossover throwdown with Baba Yaga and the Sea Witch and everybody. And, so that took a lot of planning. And initially, Raven's idea was that we were going to kill maybe 7 or 8 characters in that storyline. It was like, you know, and Joe and Ralph were like, wait a minute. Calm down. And Joe went another way with that. And so we went through that a couple of times and it became the story that it was. But, you know, so that there was definitely that process of those guys saying, okay, you know, think what you want, go big, think your ideas and we'll scale them back where it fits what we have to do with right. the line.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's, it sounds like it's a really good atmosphere to work in, though, for a creative person.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure that there's companies that people, they tie their hands and they're very stifled in, you know, what they're allowed to do.
Yeah, I feel really fortunate about a lot of it. Yeah, kind of my favorite thing of all of it. I don't know if you guys read that story or remember that story, but the Grim Fairy Tales, Myths and Legends 25 was the end of the Helios story.
Mm-hmm.
And early on, there's this whole thing, like when Helios, you know, the renegade sun god has broken out and things are going bad. And Raven had the idea of him burning a landmark. And, you know, this whole idea of his first thought was Helios burns the statue of Christ's Redeemer in Brazil to the ground. And I said, Warren Ellis did that in an issue of Stormwatch. And Raven's like, damn it. And I said, oh, I've got it. Great Wall of China. And there's just like dead silence on the other end of the phone, and I'm like, come on, Helios lights the Great Wall of China and you can see it from orbit.
Right.
They're like, whoa, that's a good one. And so we went with the Great Wall of China thing, and I even threw in a bit with the female Chinese astronaut seeing it from the Chinese space station. And seeing it, because that summer that that story happened, there actually was a female Chinese astronaut briefly aboard the space station on a supply mission.
Right, right.
And it was just one of those things that, like, the news thing connected and, like, you know, but I call, that was, I joked that that was like my Grant Morrison moment, you know. The Great Wall of China is a fire, and we look in the Chinese female astronaut with a tear in her eye, and, you know. And it was like, you know, the vista is huge. The scope is boundless, you know. I'm like, and so, you know, and they're like, settle down, Troy. but, you know, so that was, so like something like that, that's something that you're able to come up with and do when it's big and crazy. And you really feel good because you got an idea and then it works. And like Josh Hood was the artist on that. He just absolutely killed that.
Right.
This 2-page spread of the Great Wall of China on fire. Which was really cool. So, yeah, you feel really good about those things, and it's, you know, it doesn't matter quite so much sometimes that it's part of a big team effort because you know that it took everybody to get to that.
Right. Yeah, no, and that's, again, it just sounds like an awesome atmosphere to work in, and, and you know, when you have two guys like that who have a clear vision of what they want their properties to be, you're not dealing with 50 people with interpretations of what the property should be. I think that makes things easier as well. So you've worked for a lot of different companies. You've done a lot of different things. Is there any character you haven't written yet that you want, you know, would love to get your hands on?
Oh, sure. You know, the list. I would probably put the Legion of Superheroes number one.
Okay.
Which is, whenever I say that, people are like, what? But a lot of people like freak out at the idea of the Legion of Superheroes because there's so many possible characters, which is actually the thing I love about it. And I loved about that book as a kid, because you could pick it up and it could literally be anybody in the next issue. And I really, really gravitated toward that book. For that, it was just a cool vision of the future. You know, every issue could take you to a different planet of people who, like, little tiny brain people in cases that breathe methane, or aquatic people, or, you know, all these different people. Like, everybody on the planet has magnetic powers. What happens when you attack them with weapons made of plastic? I mean, you know, they're just different dilemmas and really all these kind of different things that are cool about it. But at the heart of it, they were all teenagers and they were all a mess.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was everything that is messed up and romantically melodramatic about high school, but on different planets of superpowers. And as a kid, I found that hugely appealing. And the fact that they've never made that stick as an animated series beyond the really cool one they had for two seasons, or as a TV show even, is kind of frustrating, because that is so ripe for that kind of thing. You know, and I find that I enjoy the minutia of it. I enjoy like the weird one-off powers, and I enjoy the different crazy characters. You can do kind of anything with that cast.
Yeah, I was going to say it's to me, that's a definite writer's dream, you know, because you have a freedom to get away with whatever, you know, whatever's on your tickling your fancy that week, you know?
Yeah.
Cool. I mean, it's a good answer.
Thank you. But yeah. Well, you know, I never, I just, you know, again, like slight detour, but I just did that Prince Dracula novel that Dynamite put out. And I never had any idea how much I wanted to write a Dracula story until I started writing a Dracula story. And when that happened, it's one of those things that's like, you know, you grow up with the Universal movies and the Hammer movies and everything. And I never really like sat around the house going, huh, Dracula story. I got one of those. But then you start doing it. It's like, damn, Dracula story. You know, and you start feeling it that you're doing that kind of thing. And so, I mean, imagine that there's all kinds of stuff that I don't think about right now that if the opportunity came up, sure, you know, I would love to do all kinds of those things.
Right. So as long as your Dracula doesn't sparkle, it's fine.
My Dracula does not sparkle. My Dracula is an angry, patriotic, sword-fighting son of a bitch. Patriotic to, you know, Transylvania. I'm sure that there's, you know, like his patriot is flag waving Dracula. No.
So you, Clash of Queens, issue 5 is coming out. When is it coming out? Is it out now or is it the end of the month?
The 25th, isn't it?
Yeah, the 25th.
Okay.
Copies just went to reviewers, within the last day or so.
Yes. Both John and I have read it.
Yes.
We're very disappointed. No.
Excellent. I'm so happy.
The sad thing is I haven't read
number
most of it.
Teachers I had. What was that? I'm sorry.
I haven't read most of the rest of the series, so now I'm like on your website looking at, oh, look, you have a compendium. I think I'll go get that now. But yeah, it's a really good story.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. It's that was a heck of a lot of fun to do. I can't lie about it. There's no pretense about that. Like, well, I really wanted to dissect the mechanics of the four playing cards and the original, you know, whatever. I had a ball. It was a lot of fun. And that, now, that came out real.
It looked more like you sat back and said, let them fight.
Yeah, it really. It was funny because there was already a plot in place because, you know, I joined that in progress. I took over writing that with the third issue. And it was at a certain point and there was a lot of openness. And like Ralph and Joe and Pat, you know, communicated to me, there's a little more definition with issue 3 than there was, say, with issue 5. And issue 5 was like very, broad strokes. And so there's probably more of me in 4 and 5. Okay. But again, that's you to serve them. I look at it and I kind of see where the me part is. You know, but I look at it mainly, how does this fit? How do I make it serve what they're trying to do? And how do I execute it in a way that it keeps the feel of what Wonderland is supposed to be like?
Right.
And, I felt pretty good about that. And there's one scene in particular, in 5. spoiler warnings on. A character kicks another character. And, you know, it was one of those things that I came up with where they kick them out of the hole in the castle. Mm-hmm. And at first I thought, is that too over the top? And I'm like, no, it's Wonderland. The queens are brawling. It's like, it's totally something that one of them would do. You know, it was one of those things that hit me early on. And it's like, when the hole is blown in the wall in issue 4, I'm like, somebody's going out that hole. You know, so before this is all over, somebody's going out. And it was like, and it just presented itself. And I'm like, oh, right on. This is great. And I worried about that a little bit. I'm like, they were fine with it. And, the little poem the trickster recites toward the end, you know, Pat loved that thing she recites about the Queen of Hearts.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and again, this is not spoiler. People are like, what? But I also did, and this is something that Dave from, Zenscope's marketing and I were talking about. I did a thing where the landmarks I mentioned in the course of the battle, like the Queen of Spades in issue 4, she's going across to try to get to, Queen of Hearts castle and they've burned the bridges and stuff. And, you know, Dave's like, I was looking at the script of these bridges, had some really goofy names. But then, you know, he realized I was naming them after things from like Lewis Carroll poems.
Okay.
And so I was trying to work in some of that. And like I opened the issues with the quotes from the other Lewis Carroll poems because I was really like trying to emphasize the whole scope of the Wonderland thing and to kind of point out that there were things that Carroll talked about that you could apply to the story that was going on.
Right.
And it was just cool to be able to go through that and be able to find those things and add them, which was nothing that we talked about, but stuff worked out. And I think, you know, just adds another layer to it.
No, it does. And it's, you know, I was kidding. It is very well written, and you can tell you had fun with a lot of the beats in it. And that comes across, you know, which makes it a fun read. I highly recommend everyone run out and buy the series now.
No, I appreciate that. I know you're kidding. It's, but yeah, I just hope people have a good time, with it. And I think that there are a couple of, a couple of things that I thought were pretty serious that had been set up in the story. Mm-hmm. The clubs and diamonds relationship. There's a couple of turns in that are pretty sad, you know? And that's just kind of a testament to the stuff that again, Joe and Ralph have set up, that you can have these kinds of like over the top things, but these kind of touching moments too, when you don't expect them.
Right.
Is when you really find yourselves getting into the characters. I had a similar experience with that with Sela when I wrote the Grim Fairy Tales issues with the, Warren, her character, the Jack Frost character. And, that, you know, kind of issue, like really sticking the knife in Sela's heart, this kind of like grand betrayal thing. Man, I was depressed all day, when I wrote, wrote that. I'm like, wow, I feel really bad. you know, and that's one of those things that happen. But, and similarly, you know, I'm writing the Grim Fairy Tales versus Wonderland mini, and, putting Sela in Wonderland is so joyful. That is so much fun. Because I decided to go with it. You never really, part of the context of that miniseries is the fact that you've never really seen Sela in Wonderland.
Okay.
You've seen Sela touch on the other realms and stuff. And I decided to play it that Sela just hates Wonderland because she's very kind of no nonsense and everything. And it's just like, just this Wonderland just kind of offends her in a way. And so like, you know, what she's doing, she's like just dealing with, she's over Wonderland's crap. Right. Is basically what it is. And so I thought, like, writing her from that perspective, would just be fun. And it really has been, like, a lot of fun to put her in that really kind of just, like, you know, she's barely putting up with all of it.
Right. No. I mean, and that's cool. And, you know, you gotta have fun at the end of the day when you're doing something like this, right? If it's not fun, oh, it's not worth doing, right?
Oh, yeah. It's, you have to. You know, Pat Shannon and I have talked about this a little bit, that there are, we both enjoy writing. There are people in, not just in this particular business, but in the whole idea of writing whatever it is that you write. There are a lot of people who enjoy having written. They like the idea of having something on the shelf, but they find the act of writing to be a misery. Pat and I both love the actual doing of it.
Right.
And that makes a huge difference to me. You get stressed about deadlines. You get stressed about whether people are going to like it, appreciate it, approve it, make you go back and make changes to it. Those are all things that you think about. But if you can't do it with a sense of enjoyment and with a sense of the realization that you're getting to do this, you're actually right. Getting to write comics, then I think you're kind of missing the point somewhat.
Right. No, definitely. Like, I think you hit the nail on the head. If you don't see it as a blessing, I mean, you're getting to do something fun for a living, then go be an accountant.
Right. Right.
So.
Which, yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I've got nothing.
So I'm taking from this, then you're going to keep doing this as long as it's fun.
Grim Fairy Tales versus Wonderland number 4 is my last issue. No, I'm kidding. yeah. You know, anything could change, but I don't see, like, in the foreseeable future how it could not be fun. I mean, you hear a lot of stuff. You know, the industry, there's lots of stories, and there's lots of things that have happened to people that are unfortunate in the grand history of comics.
Oh, yeah.
But if... is as far as still loving the form, still enjoying doing the work, absolutely. Still wanting to do more and more, yeah. I mean, yeah, with the webcomic thing, I'm real excited. I'm coming up to the end of, like, the third chapter of Spark Shooter, and Solo Acoustic is going to hit 50 installments this week. Wow. Those are big deals to me. Nobody's counting that down. you know? Except maybe Ben, who draws solo acoustic. He's like, oh God, thank God, 50. I'm almost done. but you know, at the same time, that's a huge accomplishment, and it only makes me want to do more of it.
Right.
It's a big deal to me personally. It's a big deal to Nkaru, who came on to take over Spark Shooter as the artist. And, you know, she's going to have the complete third chapter done, you know. That's a big deal to her.
Right.
And that kind of thing, like the little achievements, the little things you can appreciate, that's all important. Every time I finish an issue is a big deal to me. Because at a certain point you do become, when you're on your way up or trying to break in, you know, you do become discouraged. It's like, mm-hmm. I'm never going to get this done. This is never going to happen. I'm never going to sell a comic. Oh, I got one. It's never going to happen again. At least I did one. Okay, two. At least I did two. Okay, I got an arc. I got two arcs. I got a run. I got to launch an ongoing book. I got a miniseries. You know, you have to keep appreciating it. And, you know, if you don't appreciate it, you're an asshole. I'm sorry. You know, you have to appreciate it. You have to, because there are, easily 1,000 guys that would kill, well, you know, or maim,
or maim,
bludgeon, to do what you're getting to do.
Right.
And there's no shortage of people out there trying to break in, and breaking in as a writer is tough. You know, Mark Wade once joked that in comics, once you get in, they send a team of guys to seal up the hole in the wall that you got through, so no one can get through the same way. And you know, it's hard as a writer. It really is, because, and I'm not trying to be like, oh, woe is us. With an artist, you can walk up to a guy at a convention and he can see, looking at your folder of stuff, that you're awesome.
Right, right.
You know, they don't know you from any other guy that, while well-meaning, intelligent, fun-loving, imaginative, big fan of comics, might not really be able to tell a story, or might not be able to do it in the way that they want you to do. You can't get that across in a meeting or a folder or a handshake. It's almost impossible.
So what you're saying is anybody trying to get in should just give up now.
Only if they want to do what I'm doing. No. No. I know that sounds bad, doesn't it? That sounds like, I'm here to tell you I've been over the wall, and what lies beyond the wall is the death of dreams. It's hard, I guess, is the thing to say. It's hard. And if you really want to do it and you really believe in it, then you shouldn't give up. Because, I mean, I was tempted to give up, and I didn't, and I get to do this stuff now. Right. But if you're going to do it, be serious about the intent of it. Work on the work. Work on the study of it. Look at books, read prose, read journalism. Study how a narrative is put together, and by all means, figure out how to pitch something. I know that I am long-winded, believe me, and you guys are sitting there looking at your watches like, holy shit, but you know, if you know, my, Stuart Sager, artist Stuart Sager, Shiver in the Dark, Bionicle, all other things, mm-hmm. he's a friend of mine, he's from Indy as well, and, he knew a guy one time that, great writer, hired an artist, had like a whole completed book put together. And the guy tried to pitch it to, Christian, what might if I say it? Tried to pitch it to Christian Baranek at Silent Devil. And, as whole book looked great, and Christian said, you know, he didn't buy it. He didn't take the book. And Stuart said, well, why not? And Christian said, he couldn't sell it to me. I knew he had a good book there, but he lacked the conviction of what he created to get it across. And that says so much about it, because you kind of have to get over the hump. You kind of have to be able to present yourself and sell yourself and really pitch the story and hit the beats that the other guys want to hear. And sometimes you do all that and they still don't take it.
Very now, true.
Which is always a fun day around the house.
In the past, you would write something, and then the way you normally do it is you just submit until somebody finally reads it, and then somebody who reads it wants it. But in this day and age, with the net and everything, I gather you can go about it different ways, like write something and then post it and then walk up to a publisher with, hey, my site gets 3,000 hits a day because of this writing. Maybe you should take a look or something. Or is there a way that like new writers could use the new, you know, technology as it is today to get ahead?
Well, there's always bribery.
okay.
So
pyramid scam, well, right.
Certainly writ large is the idea of, making your own stuff and putting it into the hands of people so they can see you're capable of it. Hmm. And I think that Comixology, now and websites previously enabled people to do that in a way, but it's hard to get someone to look at it. The guys that do Five Ghosts at Image, made their own book. They printed their own first issue and they took it to a show and were selling it. And someone at Image actually discovered it on the con floor and bought Five Ghosts outright. You know, they're walking around. They saw it. They're like, hey, that looks cool. Let's get it. Let's get those guys at Image. So those guys took the leap of faith to actually make the book and wound up with there. There's a lot of other guys that doesn't work for. You know, I mean, look at Robert Kirkman. Everyone thinks of Robert Kirkman now as the guy who created Walking Dead, the guy that's on Talking Dead. Robert Kirkman was Battle Pope. You know, his first book was Battle Pope.
Right.
The leap of faith to get Battle Pope in front of people and go to cons and work Battle Pope. And he started getting work based on Battle Pope. And then he came up with, you know, Walking Dead, and everybody knows the story of like, if it wasn't going well by like the seventh issue, they could at least tell it. They could say aliens did it. The aliens created this. There's like a whole like apocryphal story about that, like how he was going to end it if it didn't go well, initially. But, you know, he also took that leap of faith with, Battle Pope of producing something to put in front of people.
Right.
I think that, but again, that gets back to, now, like Wade said, now a lot of people have used that trick and it becomes just as much stuff getting put in front of somebody. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do you catch them on the day that they're willing to sit, flip through all the pages of your website to read the story? Do you catch them on the day that you put the book in their hand in an elevator that they take, get back to their hotel room and read it? You know, there's mm-hmm. a lot of things, associated with that. And you have to kind of, when you do that, I think it helps that you build a fan base, you go to conventions, you work Twitter, you work Facebook, you work whatever, and you try to build a presence in a way. And I know it sounds exhausting, and it doesn't always work.
No.
But it's kind of the best thing you got right now, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's so true that, you know, there's people out there like, oh, the internet's the great equalizer and all the good stuff will rise to the top. And that's not necessarily true, because if people don't find the good stuff, it doesn't matter how good it is. If it's sitting out there, no one knows it exists.
It's literally too much information. There's too much out there, I guess, right, to wade through.
So you still have to be your own best cheerleader, your own best salesman, and get the things out there to people to see. And there's a matter of luck of catching the right people on the right day. So
yeah. And I've been in the situation where I've been on the other side of the con table or signing at the comic shop where people like literally will not buy it or look at it because it's not Marvel and DC. Mm-hmm. Can't blame Marvel and DC for that, but so enormously frustrating. It always makes me wonder how these people listen to music. it's like, you know, no, I'm sorry. I cannot listen to your other radio station. I can only listen to Bachman Turner Overdrive and, you know, I'm sorry. Like, taking care of business, Hotel California, they're enough for me. You know, that's just the kind of thing that strikes me. It's like, nope. I saw Citizen Kane. I'm good. I don't need to see your movie. But yeah, it's kind of what it strikes. It's like this. Some people exist in this incredibly narrow bandwidth. I get books from Marvel and DC. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I get other books. And so, like, it's frustrating when you're sitting there, like, trying to, like, here, look at this. Look, I've got a good artist. Nope, won't look at it. Sorry. I will not touch your book and open it to look and see if it's cool. And that's harsh. That, you talk about the great equalizer. That's the ego equalizer. I did a signing last week, and a lady came up for me and tried to pay for a drink out of the drink machine, which was awesome. Because the comic shop had a drink machine. She tried to hand me a handful of change. She's like, here you go. I'm like, excuse me? She's like, I got a Diet Coke. I'm like, Oh, you want to pay the guy over there by the cash register, not the guy with the comics and pins in front of him. Which was awesome. Like, I thought that was the funniest thing that happened all day, but it's like, wow, this lady was sent to, like, knock your ego back down.
Yes.
I am signing. Yes, here's my new book. Please, come, take my signature. It shall be worth something. Here's 50 cents. Well, there it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, man. It's interesting. And I did prevail upon a couple of people to try the book. You know, because, like, you see them carrying their stack, and it's like, oh, what you got? Walking Dead? Saga? I like Walking Dead and Saga. As a fellow fan, you should check this book out. And one guy's like, nice try. And there was a woman who was like, oh, that's cool. I'll look at that. I'm like, excellent. You know, that worked 50% of the time.
right. No, it's fascinating, too, because people even, you know, I mean, Zenoscope has been in the top 20 market share publishers.
They've been in the top 10 for
a while.
They've
been in the top 10 now for a while. And yet people still turn their nose up. People turn their nose up at Dark Horse and Image still.
Yeah. And Zenoscope thing is really interesting to me. Because sorry, guys. There is, and I've written about this, and Joe and Ralph know, and I don't think they care if I tackle this head on. There is an understanding about the Zenoscope covers that sometimes some people take an issue with them. I don't. I've never been bothered by something that someone would consider cheesecake, but because I also know what's on the inside of the book.
Right.
And my joke about that is some of the outsides may look like cheesecake, but I never write the women like dessert. I try to make fully fledged characters out of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some are smart, some are not. Some are good, some are evil, some are powerful, some are weak, some make bad choices. That's anybody. And if you're trying to adhere to the standard of writing a character like a human being with all their faults, then you're doing the work. And that said, there are thousands of other books that have comparable covers to that.
Right.
Many are worse, by that objective standard, you know? And it's funny because you try to talk to people and sometimes people don't want to hear that 50% or more of Zenoscope's readership are women. We have a huge female audience. They show up. They buy the books. They know the characters. They know us. They cosplay as those characters.
There's a lot of strong female characters in all the Zenoscope books. That doesn't surprise me, you know?
Yeah. And so that's just one of those things that sometimes you have to roll the boulder up the hill with. Yes, you look at the book, but look at the book. The book. Get it. And, you know, Pat particularly has been to a lot of shows, and with, especially lately, people dressing up as Robin Hood. And, you know, Pat is delighted by that. And I am too, because Pat frequently posts pictures of himself with people dressed as Robin Hood, and I always post under it, like, something like, oh man, my favorite part of the movie was when you guys had the contest about how many orcs you killed. That was great.
Perfect.
But, you know, I just had to throw that in there. But, you know, and I talked to, somebody, I did Indie PopCon with, Jay and Dave from Zenoscope. They were working the booth they had, and I signed on the Friday, and I talked to a woman that was cosplaying there. She was Sailor Jupiter, actually.
But nice.
When she was, picking up some stuff, and I talked to her, and she came in when I did the signing the other day, and she brought with her the White Knight issue, the Tales from Wonderland book. Mm-hmm. And that was super cool because I was really happy to see that, the White Knight book. I'm like, man, this meant something to somebody. They dug that. They like connected with that story. They brought that story back. You know, they wanted to show you that they appreciated what you did.
Right.
And when you have that kind of connection, you're like, you know, people can say what they want, but the truth is the readers are connecting with those characters. They're finding meaning in it. They know who Pat is. They know who Joe and Ralph are. They know who the cover artists are. They have an identification with those people, and those stories mean something to them. And I think that's really cool. And, you know, the idea that people put me in that group, I still find vaguely hilarious. Like, somebody came up to me at the Indiana Comic Con with, like, a whole stack. It was, like, every cover of every freaking Zenoscope book I'd written. And they're like, I want you to sign all those. I'm like, what? Like, the idea that some dude had all of those books and, you know, knew that I signed them and I mean, knew that I wrote them and brought them up, that was mind-boggling to me. It's still mind-boggling that there's that kind of association made. Yeah. It's very, very strange.
Cool. Speaking of cons, this weekend is Wizard World Philly. I know a lot of the guys from Zenoscope are going to be there. Are you going to be there?
I will not be there, unfortunately. I will probably try to get out more. It's funny because, you know, I mean, I've gone to shows like, and honestly, I'll be blunt about it. A lot of times it's an expense issue, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Some guys set their budget to do it, and some guys have a little more ability to do that. You know, I've got two kids, and we have a lot of commitments and stuff associated with that beyond just being a parent. And, you know, I've always tried to limit my travels, especially when they were younger. Mm-hmm. So going to San Diego, going to Chicago, that's something. But the irony is, in the past year or so, Indiana has suddenly started to sprout cons. Mm-hmm. The Indiana Comic Con, the Indie Pop Con, now there's allegedly a Wizard World Indianapolis happening in 15.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of like, well, damn, I didn't even have to leave the house. you know, and I had the table up at the Indiana Comic Con, and, you know, I was talking to guys, and it's like, Carrie Nord, he came from Canada. And he's like, yeah, I came from Canada here. Where, how far would you have to go? I'm like, 15 minutes. He's like, what? I'm like, yeah, it's like, I knew where I parked in the Colts parking lot. I knew where to go. It's $5 all day. You should try it. You know, it's just that kind of thing, right? You know, it's funny.
Right.
That all of a sudden, and Indiana is a big comic state. And, you know, we've been saying it for a long time, but, clearly you can't just stick to one state's cons.
Right.
But at the same time, I never felt like, in years previous, that I had, for lack of a better term, a profile that made it worth anybody's while for me to travel. You know, I wouldn't have presumed in 2010 to be like, hey, Joe and Ralph, can I come to Philly and sign one book?
right.
But now with Zenoscope in particular, I've got, you know, any number of trades that are the stuff that I've done, and like all kinds of single issues, and like the Zombies Unleashed thing, and Myths and Legends, and GFT 14 and 15, and now Clash of Queens, and Fairy Tales vs. Wonderland. That's a lot of material now.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I keep like, what's next, Pat? Like, I don't know. Like, come on, man, what's next? I really don't know. Grim Fairy Tales versus Wonderland number 4. Here's your due date. Thanks. You know, but you know, that those things, you do them months in advance. So then you work out like what's next, and then you do it. And it takes you a while to feel confident that you actually have a what's next.
right.
But with that stuff, with that kind of stuff out there, I feel like I'm more useful to them, and I feel like it's better for readers and stuff, if you can actually go and present like a wide variety of things than it is to like be just one book. I mean, there's always, you go to shows, and if you go to like, say you go to Chicago every year, there's always some dudes in Artist Alley, and there'll be some guys that have like, they've been there for 5 years, but they're there for 5 years with the same book that they made.
Yes.
And you just kind of wince at that, because you start to be like, you start to recognize, oh, these guys are going to be at that table, and it's the same thing. And you kind of feel bad, because it's like, well, is this the one thing, or did they sink so much money into producing this that they can't make anything else until they get rid of it? And, you know, that's not a knock on those guys. I feel deeply sympathetic to the effort to try to get that out. But at the same time, I never wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Prime example of a guy who's great at getting everything out there is Dirk Manning, who's a friend. But man, Dirk has really diligently worked so that when Dirk sets up a table, he's got a wide variety of stuff. He's got the Right or Wrong book. He's got the Nightmare World volumes 1 through 3. He's got Tales of Mystery. But he could sit down, he could put out like a smorgasbord of Dirk Manning material. And it's worth this, sell all that stuff. And it pays for itself. It's much harder, when you have very few things.
Right.
That you've made. Now, I think the guys would be happy to have me come out there. I think it's just a scheduling question as to like when I get to join them at some of the other places. I know Dave, was working on me about going to Phoenix, because Phoenix is kind of like a big hotbed of Zenoscope fandom. There's tons of people there. They're really into it. So
that's interesting. Because, I mean, Philly's their home base. But, I mean, I'm not saying that they shouldn't have fans all over the place. They should, but...
Yeah. We used to, when we were running shotgun reviews when it first started, you know, we'd look at the analytics, and we were always deeply amused by the fact that we had 3 consistent readers in Botswana. and one of our taglines for the longest time, like under shotgunreviews.com, was beloved in Botswana. Because, you know, who the hell knows? I guess there's the democratization of the internet right there.
Right.
Like, so, top 10 Franklin pickup lines went over well in Botswana, I guess.
So, we've actually been talking for a little over an hour now. And we usually keep these around an hour, so.
So get out is what you're saying.
No. So,
so we're going to split it.
What, John?
Is it we split it?
So, John, did you have any questions, for Troy before we wrap it up?
I'm thinking, but no, he's answered just about everything I could think of. And right now I'm just browsing, seeing if I can get all the back issues that I missed.
All right.
That's a good or bad thing.
No, it's a good thing that one issue that we're not allowed to talk about because it's not out yet is it was really good. It shows that there's a hell of a lot of plot going on that I didn't know about. So
yeah, it's always tricky, you know, to kind of like, where do I run afoul of what I'm not supposed to say?
Right.
You know, and especially when people really want to engage you in the story, and you know, you find yourself sometimes accidentally doing it, you know, or they come up, they're like, hey, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh yeah. And oh crap. Because you know, it's done to you.
Right.
You know, yeah. And sometimes it was done months ago by the time you're having the conversation, and it's like, oh crap, that doesn't sound out till next week. Sorry.
Yeah, but this isn't live. We can edit those out or bleep it.
Everybody dies.
Wait, is this Lost?
That's right.
Is this Game of Thrones?
Damn it. Clash of Queens number 5, only half of it is in Purgatory. Game of Thrones. You could start on the Game of Thrones humor associated with that.
You're going to kill half the characters. Who do you think you are, Joss Whedon? I mean, come on.
So, Troy, are you on the Twitters?
Yes, I am on the Twitters. It's a series of tubes.
Nice.
It's a series of tubes, and people can communicate with it. And one of the hardest parts of my job is obviously skating. And, oh, never mind. Troy Brownfield. And sparkshooter.com. There you go. There's my web sparkshooter.com.
All right. Yes, so definitely everyone should go check those. Follow Troy on Twitter. Check out Sparkshooter. And definitely check out Zenoscope and all of the great books by Troy and all of the great writers. And for everyone listening, I will be at Philly Comic Con this coming weekend. Just look. I'll give out. I'm not going to say where I'm at because I've already said on the podcast, everyone knows who I work for when I'm there.
Think of a musical instrument.
Look for the big display with all the pictures of the women scantily clad. There actually will be a big Alice in Wonderland cover, a big Robin Hood cover art. That's your hint.
Is this the Age of Darkness tour?
Age of Darkness tour.
Well, that's what it says on the big banner of the Zenoscope booth now. The new big banner.
No. This is an artist who's done stuff for Zenoscope, who's a friend of mine, and I always end up working at his table. And Yes.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
All right, fine. I'll just say it. I'll be at Greg Horn's table, so come by and say hello.
Greg Horn, Age of Darkness door.
Make sure
you wanted the best, you've got the best. I'm introducing metal bands now.
Make sure you pick up some prints, and then head on over to the Xenoscope table and pick up some books.
It sounded like for a second you said, pick up some prints. If you're missing that Purple Rain album, this is the convention to get it.
All right. Print. So anyway, on that note, ladies and gentlemen, as always, don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.
Speaking of capes, you can tug on ours by joining the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Google+ at Superhero Speak. If you have any comments on my bad jokes, you can email me at dave@superheroespeak.com.
You can also subscribe to our podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, and various other channels. Or if you'd like to tease the beard of knowledge, you can email me at ben@superheroespeak.com.
We also occasionally rant about things on our website, superheroespeak.com. Or, if you'd like to further discuss the prowess of Rainbow Dash versus anybody in the greater geek universe, you can email me at john@superheroespeak.com.
And don't forget to check out our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. companion show, Agents of Speak, which you can watch live most Tuesdays around 9 p.m. on our Google+ page, or archived on our YouTube channel. Now let go of our cape.